from the front lines of the green rush. This is Green Entrepreneur, where business owners talk about how they found success in cannabis and how you can too.
Welcome, everybody, to the Green Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is John Small. I'm the editor-in-chief of Green Entrepreneur and greenentrepreneur.com. And my very special guest today is Johnny Casale, who is a cultivator and owner of Huckleberry Hill Farms, which is a 5,000-square-foot sun-grown cannabis cultivation farm in the heart of Humboldt County, California. And Huckleberry Hill Farms provides award-winning quality flower to Flo Kana. And Johnny is a second-generation cannabis farmer. He grew up on the farm. But in 1992, he was arrested for growing marijuana and jailed for 10 years. But he is going to be talking to us about that experience, how he managed to turn his life around and his business around, and what his experience can teach others in the cannabis cultivation industry. Johnny, I'm thrilled to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining.
Well, thank you very much, John. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to not only share my story, but try to educate and share the story of the Emerald Triangle, because it's unique and it's special in so many different ways. And it's important that the people, that the world knows who we are and what we've been doing for the last however many years.
So let's take it back a bit here. Your upbringing, you grew up in what you call a traditional cannabis farm. Some might call it a black market, but as far as you were concerned, when you were growing up, there was nothing really illegal about it. I mean, what your parents, tell me a little bit about what the situation was. Your parents were growing cannabis on this farm, or tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I grew up on this same very farm that I live today. We moved here when I was 5 years old. I was with my stepdad and my mother, and we just moved to the country and the rural lifestyle just because it was a very special place as far as the environment and what, you know, it was just a very unique, special place. And we didn't have to be surrounded by a bunch of people, and we had to create our own type of lifestyle that we wanted to live. And so in living in the country, it's very demanding on the amount of chores that we all had to do just to be able to survive. There's roadways to take care of, painting the house, roofing the house, making sure your water system that's collected from a spring is always cleaned out every year. So it's very demanding, not only on them, but also as me growing up as a child. So I had a lot of chores that I had to do even after I was done with school.
Wow. Was your family just growing cannabis on that farm, or were you growing other sorts of agricultural goods?
So from the time I was 10 years old, I was following my mom around. She was somebody that just really loved plants of all kinds. So from my early years, I was growing, helping her grow the vegetable garden. I was helping her grow the fruit trees, the grapes, and also growing cannabis. And each different type of plant needed some kind of different care. And she was there to teach me what each different strain and each different plant needed. And just like she fell in love with growing plants, so did I. And it actually became, at one point, I remember back, it was kind of a competition, because she would do one thing to a plant, and then, you know, I would learn from her, and then I would take it to the next level, and I would go out underneath the bushes, and there was mulch that used to fall underneath the trees and underneath these certain huckleberry bushes that are grown here, and I would collect that, and I would mulch all the different plants and see how that affected the plants. And so from an early age, from 10 years old, I followed her, and I never knew that there was a difference, or I never believed there was a difference from a tomato plant or a cannabis plant. It was all just, they were all plants to me, and there was nothing very harmful. And it wasn't really until later in life, maybe when I was 14 or 15, that I noticed the helicopters were flying and that there was some enforcement going on, and that people that I knew were kind of getting in trouble, but these were the larger grows and we were typically a smaller grow. So in order to survive in Southern Humboldt or in the country, it wasn't one particular thing that you could do to make a living. It was a multiple of things. So my family were carpenters. They had a small nursery. We were commercial fishermen. So we commercial crab fish together. We commercial albacore fish together. Commercial salmon fish together. We shared vegetables with the neighbors and they shared with us. And we also grew cannabis. So it was like four or five different things that we did every year. But if you add all those up, we were able to make it to the next year. And that was the goal, is to make enough money, not to live the rest of our lives on some tropical island, but to live enough, to make enough money to be able to make it to the next year. So it was kind of unique and special. And
yeah, what an incredible idyllic childhood. I mean, in some way, I mean, obviously hard to, you know, like you said, it's hard to live on the farm. I mean, listen, I'm a city boy, so to me, it sounds like kind of heaven, like the way you grew up in a way. Grass is always greener, so to speak. So tell me a little bit about what happened in 92 and how everything sort of changed. Because as far as you knew, there wasn't really a difference between the plants. I guess as you got older, you realized that one was not actually federally legal. But again, as far as you, to you, they were just plants that needed love and care. But what happened that got you in trouble?
So as I was getting older, we're in the mid 80s now, like I think it was 1985, Ronald Reagan declared the war on drugs and enforcement started to get worse. We started to notice more helicopters doing aerial surveillance of properties looking for cannabis. And as enforcement continued to get worse and worse, my family finally just decided we've done this long enough. We want to follow our dreams. And they bought a commercial albacore boat and they went commercial albacore fishing. They sailed to China, to the South Pacific, to Alaska. And they lived mainly 11 months out of the year on the ocean. And I stayed back here and continued to take care of the farm, but also continued to cultivate cannabis. And as enforcement continued to get worse, our growing techniques had to change because you couldn't grow like we do nowadays in the regulated market. You couldn't grow where they could see them from the air. So we had to grow under trees. And when you grow a plant in a shadier condition, they stay smaller. And so to make up for what now we can grow a 10-pound plant, to make up for that, we would grow maybe 100 plants in that same area. And I didn't know back then one person that didn't grow cannabis, and I didn't know anybody that had gone to jail for growing cannabis. So relatively, I thought it was relatively safe. I figured if I had gotten in trouble for growing that maybe I would get probation. And unbeknownst to me, there was a really big difference between state and federal law. And me and my best friend, we started growing in 1990 together. And unfortunately, this guy down the end of our road turned us in. And one morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, I had 30 federal agents show up here at my house and with a 9mm gun to my head. And they came into my house and they searched my place. And at the end of the day, they gave me what looked like a little yellow speeding ticket. And the whole time I was never handcuffed. I was sitting with an officer at the couch the whole time. But at the end of the day, they left. And a year and a half later, they showed back up with an arrest warrant. And I quickly learned that there was really a giant difference between state and federal law. And from that point forward, for the next 3 years, I traveled from southern Humboldt County down to San Francisco, which is a four-hour drive, at least 2 to 3 times a month going to court because this case was federal. So I was in the federal courthouse building in San Francisco with Chief Judge Henderson, who I immediately told him that I was guilty for growing the cannabis, but it was most important for me to let him know what kind of person I was inside because I really refused to believe that for growing a plant that I could end up going to jail, and especially for the amount of time that I was looking at. But unfortunately, during Ronald Reagan's declaration of the war on drugs, there was something called the mandatory minimums. And at the end of the 3 years, I was sentenced according to the mandatory minimums and received 10 years in jail, which I had to do in federal prison. You have to do 85% of your time. So I did 8 years in prison. Then I had 5 years probation. So from the time I got busted in 1992 to the time I got busted or to the time I really got out in 2004 in probation, it was really 17 years out of my life that I kind of sacrificed for this plant. So what this means is that the stories of that we have in the Emerald Triangle need to have and need to make a difference in this new industry. These stories can't be forgotten because it was something that we all lived every single day during the course of the growing season. And it's something I ran from multiple helicopters many different times. And to this day, anybody from the Emerald Triangle, when they hear a helicopter, still, you know, puts a little extra flutter in their heart, or we all suffer from a little bit of PTSD for sure.
And I can see it's still emotional, very emotional for you. And I'm so sorry this happened to you. I mean, but again, it's your example. You know, people have to understand that where the industry was when you were arrested is so different than where it is right now. And when you were incarcerated, how many people did you meet that were in similar situations as you? Did you meet any other people like you?
There was a lot of different tax evasion people that were in there for tax evasion. There was a few cultivators that, you know, it was multiple offenses, but I went to Lompoc, California, which is a prison camp, and I had the longest prison sentence there, and there was over 350 people there. So just to make this clear, is that I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason, and nobody should feel sorry for what happened to me, because I knew what I did was illegal. And we, of course, we could all argue whether or not I deserve this much time or not. But life has a weird way of working sometimes. And I don't think I would be in the position now if it wasn't for that. Unfortunately, while I was in jail, my mother passed away. And that was one of the harder things that I had to deal with. But because of her passing, some of the things that I do here on the farm will always be the way they are. And the strains that I grow here were all that are all strains that I bred from a strain that she grew 45 years ago. So that's going to be in her honor. And that will always be part of my story and part of her story.
That's wonderful. So when you get out, what is that like for you? Because now you've been away from the farm for, you said, over 10 years. And you come back and it's kind of a, is it a different world that you come into in 2002 around that area? What was it like sort of re-entering society for you?
For me, I think re-entering back here to my family home and to this community, it became an amazing feeling, and it gave me an amazing sense of community and what the value of that is. The whole time I was gone, this community in Southern Humboldt in the Emerald Triangle reached out to me, writing me letters and stuff. And I really was able to put in perspective the value of friendship and community and family versus what the dollar means. And so I learned that lesson really quickly in there. And when I showed up back home, there was 50 people from my community that were here waiting for me to help me get my life back in order. And it's really hard to put into words what that actually means, because when you come back after being gone and isolated for that long, and to come back, you just don't know how to fit in. I didn't have any forks. I didn't have a toothbrush. And I don't want to make it sound like I didn't have anything, because, you know, I still was able to, I had my life, I had my health, I had so many things to be appreciative of, but I had this community and I had a sense of a feeling of home. And that really made a difference in getting my life back in order. And the feeling when I walked onto this property after 3,000 days of being gone was just goosebumpy, amazing. I wish everybody could feel that. And I wish I could feel that for the rest of my life. I just, after a while, you start to take things for granted. And that's waking up in the morning in your own bed. And that's looking at the sunshine or hearing the birds chirp or the frogs, you know, do their thing. So I try to remind myself all the time of how lucky I am and how lucky it is to be in a community like the Emerald Triangle has.
Did you get right back into cultivating? I mean, farming is what you knew, and that was your great passion and love. Did you get right back into farming?
Yeah, I did get right back into farming. I started immediately that first summer. I started growing the vegetable garden and taking care of the fruit trees and the grapes. I didn't grow cannabis for the first few years because I was on federal probation, who doesn't recognize it to this day. And then in 1996, you know, we had something called the 215 law where we could get a medical card. And then I started growing. Once I got off federal probation, I started growing underneath the 215 law. And just, I think I had 10 plants or something, but you know, it really triggered something inside me. It just kind of brought me back to what really excited me about that. Because the one thing I haven't really told anybody, and I just thought of it now, is when you're gone for that long, those things that you really love in life, you start to forget about why you really care and why you really love those things. I'm not describing it right, but you know, I was an avid fisherman. And I love fishing, and I knew I loved fishing, but I didn't know why I loved it. Those things in life that I loved, I just couldn't remember why. It took me several years to figure it out after a while. Like, oh yeah, that's what I like about these things.
So with cannabis, you had a similar, you remembered, it sort of brought back a lot for you when you started growing, even those few plants?
Yeah. So that's, yeah, I guess that's where we were headed. Yeah. So when I started growing cannabis and nurturing the plant and taking care of it, yeah, all of those feelings came back. And so I grew underneath the 215 law. And then I think it was in 2015, the counties in the state of California started offering a permitting process that allowed us to grow commercial cannabis. And I really wasn't thinking about signing up. And then a few days before the permitting process was supposed to end, a Black Hawk helicopter flew over my house, maybe 100 feet. The whole place was vibrating, and there was four guys out of it with AR-15s. And I called my third party consultant at that time, and I said, you know what, sign me up. I can't live like this anymore. I could never go through that. And unfortunately, going to prison isn't just about me. It's about your family and your loved ones, and they suffered probably worse than I did while I was gone. So it has such a broad effect on so many people in your lives that's the sad part about it. I'm just one, but it really affected this whole community to see me go away for growing a plant.
And tell me, so these Black Hawk helicopter and these guys jumped out of the helicopter, and what happened after that?
Well, they didn't jump out. They just were doing like an aerial surveillance, and I'm not sure what the AR-15s were all about, but they had them, and it's very intimidating and it's very scary. And it triggered something with the PTSD that just, I won't put myself in that position again, and I won't put my family in that position again.
So what happened next?
So I'm having my third party person. You know, it would have been really nice and it would have been affordable to be able to do the permitting process myself. But unfortunately, I'm a farmer. And not to say that all farmers aren't really good with the computer and really navigating the regulatory process, but I personally wasn't. And so I needed help to deal with the water board, to deal with Fish and Game, to deal with the state of California and the different counties and all the different lingo. And so I had to hire a consultant to help me through that process. And that consultant at that time was charging $150 an hour. So it was very expensive, just to be able to do something that I love to do. And what really makes it different for people in the Emerald Triangle versus people getting into the permitting process down in Southern California is we live in a very mountainous region, and there's very sensitive watersheds that are throughout the mountains that end up feeding into the different rivers that hold like coho salmon, king salmon, and also steelhead. And so Fishing Game is very protective of all those waters, which I'm very happy for. So there's all kinds of different rules and regulations that we're subject to that people in Southern California aren't. And I consider them more big ag versus the sun-grown craft cannabis.
And so you needed this help and this consultant. And once you did it that way and you spent all this money, were you able to do it the right way, the way you wanted to be doing it, and without fear of being arrested and this kind of thing?
So yeah, the latter part of that, so that you said, it was, I got to do it without fear of being busted again. And I should say, not completely fearless of being busted, because what I like to remind myself, and CNBC and CNN and Vice Magazine and a bunch of different people came here. And it was one day I was sitting in the greenhouse just reminiscing with them. And the fact still remains that this is a federally illegal thing that I'm doing. And if they showed up here tomorrow with as many plants as I have here, I could possibly get life in prison. And I know that sounds really ridiculous. And the same way I feel about it today is, far as there's no way that could happen, it's the same way I felt about it 20 years ago when I went to jail for 10 years. So it can be ridiculous and it can be foolish, but if you poke the tiger in the wrong spot, be careful, because you might get bit. And so I'm very careful about how I talk about the federal legality of this whole thing, but hopefully soon this will be federally legal.
So why do you do it? I mean, even though, like you said, the chances are very, very slim that you would get in trouble for doing what you're doing, why even take the chance? I mean, like you said, you grow other things, grapes and huckleberries and all sorts of good stuff on your farm. Is it just strictly financial, or are there other reasons for continuing to cultivate cannabis?
Well, financially, this has not been profitable at all to this point. But I've only been a permitted farm for the last few years. So just like any new business, we got to give it a little bit of time. We need to work it out with the counties and the regulatory system and try to figure out what's going to work for the whole state. And once this, I think, opens up federally, I think that people will learn what the Emerald Triangle is all about, and there'll be just a giant demand. But for me, it's like I said before, it's not really about the money. It's about making a difference in people's life and changing people's opinion of what we're about in the Emerald Triangle, because it's a very unique and special place. And to have the ability to produce such a high quality product and just be able to share that with the world and be able to get feedback from people telling me that, you know, I have anxiety, I wasn't able to sleep, but thank you so much for sharing your strains with me. It's made me feel so much better. It's like a cabinet maker building these beautiful cabinets for the last 40 years and never being able to share that with anybody. And now we're able to share that with the world and we get this feedback. Maybe it's something I've always needed. We've always been doing something we love, but we've never been able to openly talk about it and openly get feedback from the consumer that's actually smoking or using our product. And one of the most amazing things, a couple years ago, my product was shared with 50 of the biggest stars in the Academy Awards. And then Willie Nelson, who white labels product from Flocana, he picked up all my different strains that my mother helped me create. And so it's a huge honor to be working with Willie Nelson and having a relationship with him, because our values also align. And I've had the pleasure of meeting him and his team, and they're the most amazing, genuine people, and they want nothing more than to bring the consumer the best, cleanest product they can possibly bring them. So it's a wonderful relationship with Lacana and with Willie's, and it's been an amazing experience.
So tell me a little bit about how you forged a relationship with a company like Flocana.
So the nature of the relationship with Huckleberry Hill Farms and myself and Flocana started back in 2016 when I met the founder of Flocana, Michael Steinmetz, and he was at an event in the Emerald Triangle, and I ran into him on Highway 101 at a Meet the Farmer event. And I had some really special, unique flower that was early a month, that was ready a month earlier than most of the other cultivators. It's just a strain that my mom had grown 45 years ago. And so he found that very interesting, and him and I hit it off right off the bat. And I really liked the kind of genuine person that he was, because I was looking. My main goal really is to find a distributorship that has the same values as I do. Because once we start as a small farmer in the Emerald Triangle to compromise our values, then all of a sudden we're just like the rest. And we're not really like the rest. And the consumer and the rest of the world just hasn't figured that out yet. But Flocana has, because Flocana has been a part of my life for the last 3 years. And even though we're not considered to be partners, I like to think of us as a partnership, because really without all the different things that they do for me, I don't know how I would move forward in the regulated market. And by that, I mean, they process, they manufacture, they market, they brand. I mean, it takes me from 4:30 in the morning to usually at dark just to cultivate and to take care of the cannabis. And so to add all those additional things would be really, I'm not going to say I couldn't do it, but it would be very problematic. So this relationship that we have has just been amazing. Their values are the same as mine. They care about the environment. They care about community is huge. And they've been to my farm. I had to earn the right to cultivate for Flocana. That's what I like to tell people is, like I just said, I just wasn't able to say, here's my product, take it, sell it for me. They said, you know what, before we get your product, we want to come to your farm. We want to evaluate what your values are. So at the same time as I was evaluating them, what their values were, they were doing the same to me. They were watching how I was cultivating. They wanted to make sure that my farm was sustainable, that I had that I was using solar to assist in some of my growing techniques. They wanted to make sure that I had like rainwater catchment and I wasn't taking out of the spawning tributaries on the side, on my property. And so I think it was a really good fit. And it's been a great experience for me to have them help me move into the regulated market after being in what I like to call the traditional market for the last 40 years. And that's what most people would call the black market.
I'm so sorry to hear that your mom passed away. And what do you think your mother would think now about what you're doing? And would she be very proud of you and carrying on this legacy that she taught you?
You know, she had a really, really hard time when I got in trouble. She was alive when that happened. And as an Italian, she felt tremendous guilt. But she also knew she raised me to be a stand-up person and really value other people. So whether or not it took me to go to jail to learn that, I think she would be proud of the course that I've taken forward now, and that I'm really sticking up for what I've created over the years, and that I really want to make a difference in people's lives. And it's very rare and that you meet somebody that just wants to help somebody else and not get anything in return. And I think the consumer is just really looking for that kind of person. And Flocana's put together a team from the Emerald Triangle that really care about other people. And it's just going to take a while to educate those people that's who we are, because it's important to know who your farmer is. That's the most important thing that a consumer should figure out. And that just takes time.
And how does the consumer, how are you making the consumer aware of
who you are. I mean, obviously you're doing this podcast, which is great because people can get to know you in a more intimate way, but just somebody buying a Flokana, purchasing a Flokana product, how are they able to vet the farms? Because not all farms are created equal and not every farm is like a Humboldt County farm with this great tradition. So what would you recommend? Or is it just more about understanding, just like you would know about which winery you like the most? Is it a similar kind of example of like?
Yeah, it definitely takes a little bit of work on the consumer's part. Most of us participate with social media, with Instagram. And so we can share our farms throughout the year and they can learn through that who we are. I grow a plant every year and I donate it to the veterans. I donate to the nonprofits around here that take care of the environment. So after a while of watching us and how we interact with not only community, but the consumers, you can learn who they are. And also Flokana offers, if you go to their webpage, there's also things about us, our individual farms that Flokana works with or with Willie works with. And Dr. Bronner's also is working with Flokana. And so they're putting together a good team that really is representing a lot of the small farms in the Emerald Triangle. And like I said, we had to earn the right to grow for them.
Now, you mentioned you're not profitable yet with the cannabis part of your business. Is that because of, have the regulations, since it's become legalized, have the regulations, the rules made it so prohibitively difficult and expensive for farmers that it is hard sometimes for them to make a profit as quickly as they used to back in just when it was a traditional cannabis market?
I would agree with that. I would say, especially the farms in the Emerald Triangle, it is very expensive. And now we're all faced with trying to deal with this new track and trace system called Metric that the state has just implemented. And I just worked on, since harvest season for my farm is done, I dried the product, I bucked it down, and I have to keep it all track and traced. And the other day, it took me like 9 hours to implement all the tags on the boxes and then entered in the computer. And then yesterday, again, when I went to transfer it, it took me another 6 hours. Yeah, maybe somebody could do it faster, but it's so time consuming and really all the numbers and stuff that they're getting from us, I'm trying to figure out what they mean because it's totally different than all the other states. Because since we're sun-grown outdoor cannabis mainly, it's really hard to track and trace product because every plant is different. Every size of the plant, everything about it is totally different than indoor. So they're also figuring out their systems. And as they figure them out and as they change what they're doing, it's very expensive to keep changing our processes. If we can hold out a little bit longer and we can just let them figure out what they're going to do, we've adapted for many years. So I'm a believer that we'll be able to pull this off.
I would imagine that you know people, and obviously we're not going to name names here, who are growing, who would be happy to just work within the what I might call the black market, what you would call the traditional market, because there's not any of these cost prohibitive restrictions and stuff. What's to stop them from continuing to provide for the black market? Because I mean, it seems like there's all these regulations are driving good, hardworking folk into the black market because that's the only way they can survive.
Yeah, well, what the industry is finding out now that it is driving a lot of the different cultivators to sell on the black market because there's so many different taxes. And so even all the way down to the consumer level, they're also being charged so many different taxes that they're like, well, what's the difference between buying it from the guy on the corner and then buying it to a retail shop? So you basically, if you go to a retail shop, you're going to pay twice as much. So what they're doing is now they're relying on the guy on the corner. And because of the very heavy flower tax that we have to pay. So if I sell a pound of product for $1,300, I get taxed $150 just flower tax. But I don't only grow AAA flower. Nobody grows just AAA flower. So on a certain plant, you might have 10 or 20% of that might be AAA that sells for the high dollar, $1,300. But you also are going to have a lot of product that is AA or single A. And maybe that's because of the structure, the size, or whatever it might be. But that's also getting charged at $150. So like if I sell product for $400, I'm still getting taxed $150. So they're taking 40% of that product. Then I also have to pay for my square footage fee for the county, my annual licensing fee for the state, the water board, the fishing game. They're lined up actually on my counter that just a mile long of different fees that we have to pay. So, you know, I've been talking to a lot of different senators and congress people and really sharing, and they're learning as we go too. They didn't know all this stuff. And so it's about educating not only the consumer, but also the regulatory people too.
Do you have some concerns that like big agriculture is going to come in once it does become federally legal? It seems like once it becomes federally legal, a lot of these problems will go away. The black market will go away, hopefully, or it will be lessened and fear of being arrested again will go away. But it will also maybe open the door for big agriculture to come in and undercut some of the smaller craft farmers. Does that concern you and the people up in Humboldt a lot? Is that something that keeps you up at night?
Yeah, I would be lying to say that I wasn't concerned about it. But over the last, and that was more so the last few years, it's becoming less that I'm worried about it in the last 6 months. And moving forward, I'm not so much worried about it, because what I've learned very quickly and what the big ag is learning is that they don't have the ability to take care of and to touch every single plant like I do. And so I walk out in the morning with my coffee, time is daylight, and I look at every single plant that's grown here and I touch every plant. So just like a child or a kid that goes to private school, each plant grown here and most of the small craft cannabis farmers in the Emerald Triangle, they get to interact with each plant. So each plant gets its special attention. And no matter what they say, it can never come out as good as if you give each plant that kind of attention. So not only is the climate and the terroir that we have here special and unique and different and what I'm considering better than anywhere else, but it's really our ability to interact with every individual plant that gives us that advantage over them. And it's, you know, we do also have a genetic history here that they also don't have access to right at the moment. So it's just going to take a lot of time to educate the consumer. And I really believe in their ability to figure out how special we are. Just I'm hoping that we can outlast. You know, we were all hoping it was only going to take a couple of years, but maybe it's a 5 year, maybe it's a 10 year long game. So that.
What is that sort of perfect vision that you imagine happening to your industry, to this industry, you know, in 5 years out from now? What do you sort of hope happens?
I hope that the consumer can realize that just because flower that's on the market that has a high THC doesn't mean that it's any better than product on the market that is 15% THC. It's more about the terpenes and about how those terpenes interact with each individual in its special way. So that, I think, will come over time. And that is my big push for this next coming year, is really to share and educate the consumer that just because it has high THC doesn't mean it means it's good quality product.
And you're working with Flokana to get that message out to the consumer.
Yeah, we're working with Flokana and we're trying to figure out how to address it, because it's a lot harder and it's very complicated to really address that at this exact time, because the market is so demanding of high THC product, and they also have to run a business. And, you know, when the market is demanding a certain product, you have to supply that product at the same time as trying to educate. So it's a slower game, and maybe that's up to the farmers that are working with Flokana to take on that challenge. And that is a challenge that I think will really, it's going to take a while, but I really look forward to it because it's so important.
Johnny, thank you so much for doing this interview with me. It's been really illuminating and fascinating, and I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot. Thank you for giving us a window into this world up of Humboldt County, California, this magical Emerald Triangle.
Well, thank you. And I really would love to encourage you to come here someday and feel the magic. And there hasn't been a person here yet that hasn't come here that it hasn't changed their lives. So for me, that's what gives me goosebumps at the end of the day. And changing people's lives and making a difference is so important. So I appreciate you taking this message and sharing it with the people.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Green Entrepreneur Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and other podcast hosting services. Check us out at greenentrepreneur.com. Download our app at Green Entrepreneur. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We are everywhere and we would love to hear from you. So please give us a shout out. Love to hear from our audience. Until then, we'll THC you later.